Welcome back, Constant Listeners. This is your grateful host, Nick Deulius. I'm going to start this episode of The Far Middle with a happy Columbus Day to all, albeit a few days late. His feats as an explorer making it to the New World represent a great exemplar of human achievement, and he's a point of pride, as is the holiday for Italian Americans. And yes, I know he was far from perfect, especially in modern-day hindsight, but then again, who or what is perfect under such a 2020 lens? Greatness doesn't always often equate to perfection or sainthood. Of course, we start with our sports dedication of the week, and I've got a trio of dedication subjects this week, moments that share a few things in common. First, all three are viewed as some of the most epic and eventful games in the history of their respective sports. Two for baseball, one for hockey. Second, all three quite memorable games were not the deciding game to win the championship or the medal that year in that sport. But today, everybody seems to forget about the next game because these three games were so memorable. All right, so what three games forever inscribed in our sports minds that were not the final game to win it all am I speaking of? Check them out. Let's go in sequence of time. We're going to go from the oldest to the most recent. The first was the 1975 World Series, Game 6, Boston Red Sox versus Cincinnati Reds, two dynastic teams of that era. This is the game at Fenway where Carlton Fisk, the Red Sox great, the catcher, he hit a line drive down the left field line, and he famously was waving the ball fair, willing it fair with his hands as it sailed over the Green Monster for a home run. It was in the bottom of the 12th inning. It ended Game 6 in exhilarating fashion for the home crowd, and many a baseball historian call it the greatest World Series single game ever. But it was only Game 6, and it tied the series 3-3. The Reds won Game 7 at Fenway and took the series. A lot of sports fans who know the famous Game 6 and Fisk's home run, they think the Red Sox won that series. They didn't. They lost it the next game. The second game was in hockey a few years later. Early 1980 at the Lake Placid Olympics, you probably know where I'm going with this one, the Miracle on Ice game where young collegians from America beat the professionals of the Soviet Union. Al Michaels and his famous line, "Do you believe in miracles?" Point of pride for a nation when we desperately needed one. But that wasn't the gold medal game. The next game was for the gold where the United States beat Finland. And we trailed at the end of that second period by a goal in that game against the Finns. And legendary coach Herb Brooks, he turned to his players in the locker room after the second period, and he looked at them and he said, "If you lose this game, you'll take it to your effing graves." And he then walked toward the locker room door. He paused, looked over his shoulder, and said to them again for effect, "Your effing graves." Well, Team USA came back in the third period to defeat Finland 4-2. So they didn't have to take the loss to their graves. They got the gold medals instead. The third game in our trio of dedications, it heads back to baseball and the World Series, this time in 1986. But like the 1975 Carlton Fisk home run, this was also a Game 6 that was also in extra innings. Mets versus Red Sox at Shea Stadium in Queens. Poor Bill Buckner. Great player in his time and during his prime, but then his body started to fail him and he has some creaky knees. And with those creaky knees, he was in the field at first base. He let a simple ground ball that would have ended the game, or I'm sorry, would have ended the inning, not the game, but would have ended the inning. The game was tied up at the time. It dribbled through his legs, allowed the Mets to score and win Game 6 in the bottom of the 10th inning. Now, who hit that ball? Mookie Wilson did. But it was only Game 6, and it tied up the series at 3 games apiece. The Mets, despite all the excitement, didn't win anything that game. They simply survived elimination to get to a deciding Game 7, and the Mets prevailed in Game 7 to take the title in New York. Ironically, Buckner had a strong Game 7 at the plate, but it wasn't enough. So there you have it. Three unforgettable games, the best or some of the best ever in their sports, that millions of fans recall the iconic moments from, but they were not the deciding game to win it all. Human nature, sometimes we remember the remarkable, and sometimes we forget it wasn't the final move that led to the ultimate objective of a title or a medal. Episode 178. goes to Carlton Fisk in his body English to wave a home run ball fair over the green monster. It goes to young Americans believing in miracles to beat the Russians on ice. And it goes to poor Bill Buckner, having one defensive lapse at a critical moment, threatened to define what was in total a great career. Let's start our connections for the week by going from rivalries on the sporting playing field, Americans versus Russians, National League versus American League in the World Series, and so on, to that of rivalries in major American political parties and philosophies. And I want to acknowledge at the outset a piece by John Fonte of the Hudson Institute, who did an excellent job of summarizing this rivalry and rift within what I suppose would most aptly be described as the conservative movement in American politics. Now, I made the mistake of attributing this rift within the conservative movement of that being between Trumpers and never Trumpers. And a lot of people do, more specifically, chalking up the differences to a personality conflict that manifests on a national level. But I've come to understand that it's much more than personality conflict at play, that it is fundamentally ideological in nature and deep-rooted. Now, there are two movements within the conservative community these days, and Fonte named them national conservatives and freedom conservatives. The national conservative movement is deemed by some as the third wave of the conservative movement, while the freedom conservatives, they're deemed as the second wave of conservatism. And both movements have issued a statement of principles that attempt to summarize what they stand for. But what is it with all these sort of waves of conservatism that I just spoke of? So it might be helpful to start there. The first wave of American conservatism, that started decades ago with people like William F. Buckley as its leader, the National Review, that magazine with its column contributors and readers on the subscription list. The first wave of American conservatism was concerned first and foremost with virtue and liberty, the belief that freedom was a prerequisite for a decent society. And the first wave of American conservatism was able to hold all conservatives together because, if nothing else, there was a big common enemy to fight, which was the Soviet Union and communism. Now, when the Cold War ended, American conservatism, it entered a new era that focused on globalization. And this is when things like NAFTA, enticing China into the WTO, those types of things occurred. And the official policy of the second wave of American conservatism was summed up by President George W. Bush in 2005 when he said that the goal of American foreign policy was to, quote, seek and support the growth of democracy in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world. That's how President George W. Bush put it. Now, the second wave of American conservatism focused on free trade, growing immigration responsibly, and above all else, globalization. Paul Ryan was another major leader of the second wave movement. Then came the third wave of conservatism. In a word, it was about revolt from the second wave, especially when it came to globalization, trade, and immigration. President Trump seized the mantle of the third wave revolt and has for years now been the leading figure of third wave conservatism. Now, if you want to think about the rift between national conservatives and freedom conservatives today, think of it simply as a divide between the third wave and the second wave of the American conservative movement. Again, it's easy to also identify this as a pro-Trump and never-Trumper thing within the Republican Party, but its roots are much more nuanced and deep-rooted philosophically, the differences are, that is, than that simple summation of being pro or anti-Trump. Back to those statements of principles of the national and freedom conservative movements that I mentioned. The national conservatives, again, headed by President Trump, does not look to defend the status quo as much as it calls for a counter-revolution to return what it deems to be sensible norms to society. Restoration of virtues that you find with patriotism and religion and family and other traditional norms. The counter-revolution and the return to those norms, those are prerequisites to recovering and maintaining freedom and security for Americans from the perspective of the national conservatives or that third wave of conservatism. And another key tenet of national conservatives is the sovereignty of the nation over the authority of international institutions like the UN and the sovereignty of the Constitution over bureaucrats and judges looking to make their own law. And of course, a whole spectrum of moral and social issues. Control of immigration, that's also toward the top of the list for the national conservatives. And in some ways, I suppose one could summarize the national conservative platform as a binary contrast and a repudiation of the New York Times 1619 Project. And some describe the movement as anti-woke, although I think that's too simple and too shallow of a description, much like trying to define it as simply Trumpism. There's more to it, and it's more complicated than those simple descriptors. Now, the freedom conservatives, or that second wave of conservatism, as I said, it also has a statement of principles, and it's pretty uncontroversial, at least from a conservative perspective. It cites the importance of individual rights and private enterprise, rule of law, equal opportunity, secure borders is in there. And it's also the type of components that any conservative, including a national conservative, would agree with. But the statement of principles and the purpose of the statement of principles from the freedom conservative movement was to effectively repudiate that of the national conservative principles and movement. Now, interestingly, there is no reference to God in the freedom conservative statement of principles, and it makes no reference to virtue. So in some ways, the freedom conservative movement is more of a split from the first wave of conservatism created by William F. Buckley and embraced by individuals like Ronald Reagan than the current national conservative movement. In other words, think about this. Some argue that the movement headed by Trump is more in line with the first wave of conservatism represented by Buckley and Reagan than the freedom conservative movement that some label as Never Trumpers. And here's another key example of why that statement may be true. First wave conservatism did not embrace foreign policy views of the freedom conservative movement when it came to promoting worldwide democracy. So first wave conservatism was certainly anti-communist, no doubt about that, but it stopped short of specifying a duty to advance democracy everywhere. Interesting. And perhaps the biggest difference, the crucial differentiator between national and freedom conservatism has to do with the struggle against the left. Freedom conservatives view it as a struggle over policy, not a fight to the death. But national conservatives view the battle with the left almost to the level of civil war, an existential fight over the future of America. And I guess you could also interpret that difference as the former looking to work within the existing and traditional system, and the latter looking to fundamentally change the existing and traditional political system, sort of Washington insiders versus outsiders. How a conservative would approach situations like that of Disney, a private corporation, a publicly traded company, it will tell you much about whether they are national or freedom conservatives. It sort of serves as an acid test. Freedom conservatives would argue that culture should be neutral zones free of government influence, period. National conservatives, or third wavers, they see culture as critical to the struggle for America's future, and thus government should play a role with respect to what Disney says or does if Disney steps out of line, depending on how you define what's in line and what's out of line, of course. But what national conservatives and freedom conservatives, and for that matter, classic or traditional liberals and libertarians like myself, what they all agree upon is an affirmation of the idea of America as something special. That they all agree on, even though they seem to disagree on everything else. The left, however, it views America as in need of a revolutionary transformation because it views America and its history as deeply problematic. A lot of what we call progressives, they fit that mold, because many who are labeled as progressive are simply leftist. And that's something that's quite different from those prior groups of conservatives, whichever stripe they may be, classic liberals, libertarians. And that's something, when it comes to what the leftists want, that I fundamentally disagree with. And understanding these nuances within the conservative movement, it's important if one is interested in preserving and strengthening the concept of America. Focus on what the conservatives and the classic liberals and the libertarians agree upon, that being the uniqueness and sanctity of America, so that the first order of business for all is to defeat the left in its attempt to dismantle America. All this talk about conservatism and classic liberalism and libertarianism creates an opportunity to make a connection to a dot that I've been meaning to highlight on this podcast for, goodness, I don't know, maybe a year. And this is the great Austrian economist Friedrich Hayek and his classic book, The Road to Serfdom. Now, the man and that book catalyzed so much within Western and American political thought. Conservatives to classic liberals to libertarians, they all view The Road to Serfdom with great regard. It is an awesome book. I encourage anyone with a passing interest in economics or an economic policy or theory to give it a read. But the book almost never saw the light of day and was almost never published. Hayek submitted The Road to Serfdom to three American publishers, and each of them rejected it in order. A colleague of Hayek put him in touch with the University of Chicago Press, who agreed to publish his book in 1944, and the initial print run was only 2,000 copies, which of course is quite modest. But then something quite fortuitous happened. Reader's Digest published a condensed version of The Road to Serfdom, and that version made its way to millions of living rooms across America. After that, everyone wanted a copy of his book, and today, The Road to Serfdom has been translated into 20 languages and has sold millions of copies. I've always been a fan of Reader's Digest, reading it as a kid at my grandparents' house, but if I needed another reason to be a fan of it, I guess I just found it. And the teachings in The Road to Serfdom, they matter greatly today. Those teachings inform when it comes to the national and freedom movements of conservatism we just discussed. And it informs as to the dangers of state control and state intervention into free markets and individual rights. Intervention in one necessarily results in interference with the other. And that was obvious to Hayek and others when he published his book toward the end of World War II, with perfect examples of the dynamic in plain view for everyone to see, including what was going on with Stalin and the Soviet Union and Hitler and Nazi Germany. And here's how Hitler viewed the state's role when it came to intervening an economy. He said this in 1941, "A sensible employment of the powers of the nation can only be achieved with a planned economy from above. As far as the planning of the economy is concerned, we are still very much at the beginning, and I imagine it will be something wonderfully nice to build up an encompassing German and European economic order." Again, that was from Hitler in 1941. Now, of course, Hitler, he meshed state control of economy with state control of the individual. It was seamless, and there was no segregation of the two. Hitler knew how to use coercion to get what he wanted from the private sector and within an economy. In 1937, he laid out his tactics on this front by saying, "I tell German industry, for example, you have to produce such and such now. I then return to this in the four-year plan. If German industry were to answer me, we're not able to, then I would say, fine, I will take it over myself, but it must be done. But if industry tells me we will do that, then I am very glad that I do not need to take that on." Again, Hitler, 1937. Today, proponents of the left and of state intervention into the free market, they're a bit more nuanced than Hitler was back in the day. Today, it's bureaucrats taking liberties with interpretations and creation of regulations. Today, it's elected officials telling industry what it desires or he or she desires, and then threatening the use of a pen to make it happen if industry doesn't go along. But the end result will be the same over the long haul, in that the individual and the free market and the idea of America, they're all going to suffer. Speaking of those important and precious things suffering, let's make a connection to how things are looking when it comes to the nation's balance sheet and income statement, as well as employment for the citizenry. I'm worried, and you should be too. The data are pleading with us to be so. Let's start with the nation's and the federal government's finances. Outlays of the federal government so far this year, as of August, $6.3 trillion. That's a 7% increase when you exclude so-called savings from the failed student loan forgiveness effort. Social Security benefits were $1.3 trillion. That's an 8% increase, driven by both cost of living adjustments as well as new enrollees into the Social Security program. Medicare, that came in at just under $850 billion, which was a 10% increase, driven by new beneficiaries and higher service costs. Net interest on the public debt, that's ugly, came in at $870 billion, which is up an unbelievable 35%, thanks to both higher debt levels and higher borrowing costs. Interestingly, military spending came in at $750 billion, which was up 7%. And unfortunately, that is not keeping pace with rising geopolitical risks. The Congressional Budget Office, or the CBO, it's projecting a $2 trillion deficit for the entire fiscal year of 2024. We experienced, I'll remind you, a deficit of $2 trillion in 2023, when you exclude, again, those so-called savings from the student loan forgiveness scheme. Consecutive years of $2 trillion deficits isn't going to help what is an already unmanageable debt pile. The government debt and our out-of-control budget, those are the single largest set of crises or problems that gets almost no attention in Washington and politics and with policy these days. We've talked about it time again on the far middle, but as the data keep unfolding and time keeps elapsing, the situation looks more and more bleak. And things aren't much better when it comes to employment and workforce once you look past the headline numbers. Now, most of mainstream media was reporting that median inflation-adjusted household income increased from a year ago for the first time since 2019. Those were the headlines about a month ago, just over a month ago. Media celebrated, but you know what? There's serious trouble lurking beneath that headline. And the first sign of trouble is what's going on with Hispanic, Black, and Asian workers. They didn't experience statistically significant income growth. And there's another problem when you assess real median earnings for full-time workers. Last year, it declined 1.6%, and it declined double that rate for high school graduate full-time workers, which means inflation outpaced wage gains for most low-wage workers. Yeah, you look beyond the headline numbers when it comes to employment and wage growth, and you see trouble. And you also begin to understand why many Americans are not upbeat about the economy and why they're quite worried. Closing time for episode 178 of This Far Middle. Time flies in this space, does it not? We've been talking about what? Resisting the left, resisting communism. We talked about things that inspire movements, political and other. And we spoke about greatness manifesting in a game that might be part of a bigger goal or objective. Now, I can't think of a better final connection for this episode and its themes than to pay homage and recognize the anniversary that occurs on this airing date of October 16th. That's the day when in 1978, a cardinal from Poland was elected pope and took the name John Paul II. It was a great day for the Catholic Church, and it was a great day for the world at large. John Paul II was a fascinating individual. Now, here's a few lesser known facts about the great man. Now, most know that John Paul II was the first non-Italian pontiff in a long time. But did you know he was the first in 455 years? That's a really long time. Before he became pope, when he would work with youth, he would love to read from books, including C.S. Lewis's classic, The Screwtape Letters. That's a cool and clever book if you are familiar with it. And if you haven't read it, I'd suggest that you give that one a read right after The Road to Serfdom. Now, how about this one? While the communist government in Poland allowed the church in Poland to nominate its own candidates to replace vacancies, the government asserted the right to reject any candidates that they didn't like. So in the early 1960s, Zenon Klitschko, the chief ideologist of the Polish Communist Party, vetoed seven candidates put forward by the Roman Catholic Church to be bishops. And the party ideologist reasoned that a gentleman by the name of Karol Wojtyla, who had expressed little interest in mundane politics, he could be manipulated easily. So he approved Mr. Wojtyla, or Father Wojtyla, into that opening that the Roman Catholic Church wanted to fill. Now, this has to rank as one of the most monumental miscalculations of the 20th century, because that pick, Father Wojtyla, or Bishop Wojtyla, eventually became Pope, Pope John Paul II, a pope who comes back to Poland to topple communism. How about that? Now, his travels exceeded 775,000 miles. That's equivalent to three trips to the moon. Many of those miles in sort of the early versions of the Popemobile. He felt the duty to travel and reach the entire flock, saying once, "Aren't I supposed to be Pope for all the world?" If you put together everything he wrote, he was indeed a prolific writer. It would equal the length of 20 Bibles. He averaged more than 3,000 pages a year during his pontificate alone. And he was driven, always looking to expand his horizons. John Paul II had an incredible work ethic, described as a volcano of energy by someone close to him, and it wasn't unusual for him to work 12 to 16 hours a day. He had a gift of split concentration, where he could have a full-on conversation with you while he was reading and still be present and be able to engage in the conversation. In fact, so powerful was his urge to constantly be multitasking, to constantly be feeding that intellect, that he even brought reading material into the papal conclave shortly before his own election as Pope. And of all the books to have on him, he was reading Marxist literature. And he told his friend, when his friend asked him about it, if you want to understand the enemy, you have to know what he has written. Exactly. The man was truly inspirational. One or two of Pope John Paul II's in the world, that makes a big difference. We do need a few more like him today, don't we? And unfortunately, what we have leading the Vatican today is far from John Paul II. I don't know about the possibilities of finding a few more Pope John Paul II's out there, but I do know we will have a few more episodes of The Far Middle in the coming weeks. And always, always remember to stay connected to that far middle.